Moving on now from the power of invisible market forces to the power of words.
Poetry is an intelligence.
That's Ellen Bryant-Voigt, also a winner of this year's MacArthur Genius Award. She's lived in Vermont for more than 45 years. She was the state's poet from 1999 to 2003, and she's written 8 books of poetry. And she says, in a world bombarded by what she calls discursive information, poetry does something essential.
Poetry slows us down, and that's because the language is charged and weighted. Unlike language in a newspaper, which is there to deliver that discursive information. Mm-hmm. The intent in poetry, I think, of the language is clarity of a complex kind.
When you said poetry is an intelligence, I don't think I've ever heard it described that way.
Well, I think that statement wouldn't surprise you if I said mathematics. Mathematics is an intelligence, or science is an intelligence. Would it? Would that seem odd to you as a formulation?
I think I probably would have reacted honestly the same way, because maybe it's my limited personal definition of what an intelligence might be. You know, I was just thinking, like, that's usually the description for a sentient being of some kind. But here we are talking about an endeavor, you know, a practice, a craft.
Well, poetry is a lot smarter than anybody who ever wrote a poem. And it goes back for centuries. And it has collected unto itself perceptions, insights, the same way I think of science. But having read what scientists say about when they enter into that craft or that discipline, that they're building on everything that went before. Who is it that said they're standing on the shoulders of the people who had made previous discoveries?
Isaac Newton.
There you go.
So Ellen Bryant-Voigt, she expresses an intelligence. She practiced a craft. And in speaking with her, it does feel very much as if she's a scientist of words, as we said a little earlier, or maybe a researcher of meaning. But what is it that makes her a MacArthur genius? Well, just listen to her read her poem, Headwaters.
Headwaters. I made a large mistake. I left my house. I went into the world. It was not the most perilous, hostile part, but I couldn't tell among the people there who needed what. No tracks in the snow, no boot pointed toward me or away. No snow as in my dooryard, only the many currents of self-doubt. I clung to my own life raft. I had room on it for only me. You're not surprised. It grew smaller and smaller, or maybe I grew larger and heavier. But don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I try to do better.
That's Ellen Bryant-Voigt reading her poem Headwaters. What's going on in Headwaters? And yes, you are trying to do better.
Well, what do you see going on in there?
Okay, well, I mean, that's a good question. Okay, so I see someone who's a little confused, a little uncertain about leaving a protected space, but yet doing the best she can outside of that protective space and, not certain of herself, but certain that she's making progress.
Excellent. That's great. Yes, indeed. I mean, in a way, it's a kind of birth poem. It's the beginning of a journey of the individual self or the individual soul that has to go out into the world. And the world is fraught. The world is fraught.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So just that kind of raising of the questions, and to try to raise the questions in a way that feels authentic, not necessarily autobiographical, but just authentic to what human experience is.
It does, because I have to say that there's several parts of this poem that I feel like I recognize within myself. Like when you write that your own life raft, did it grow smaller or maybe I grew larger and heavier? I mean, that to me is, it kind of defines the process of growing up, which we all go through basically until the day we die. Is it we who understand more about the world, or does the world feel smaller? And it's impossible to tell the difference between the two sometimes.
Yes, it is. I think it certainly is.
I mean,
yes.
Do you think that it's part of a poet's job or mandate to go outside and confront, as you said a little bit earlier, the very, very fraught world that we're living in?
Well, I think that what the poet tries to do is observe the world and use poetry as a way to understand it. I mean, because in the world of feeling, of emotional experience, which is part of being human, you don't get just one emotion at a time. You don't feel You don't feel just angry or just happy or any of those things. They come really clustered together.
Yeah.
Really clustered together.
You know, when I look at Headwaters, I think, how did Ellen Bryan Voigt do that? How did this poem come into being?
Well, two things about that. I've tried at the end of every book. I write very, very slowly, and I'm also a very willful and didactic person. And so I have set myself the challenge at the end of each book to try to do something that I had not tried before. And it usually takes the form of do not write any more poems with trees in it or whatever it is, so that one can avoid mannerism. Mm. But it did seem to me that this notion about bringing in the world or the complexity of the world, bringing it in, that could happen better if I had a more flexible poetic line. Poets are lucky among all the writers, because we have two rhythmic systems. We are writing in sentences, and we want the sentences to be clear. We want the reader to be able to make meaning out of what we say. And that is a rhythmic system. That's the way the brain processes syntax. It does it over in the areas of music. And that's the way children learn how to make sentences. So we have that rhythmic system. And then we have this other one that is wholly artificial, coming from the root word artifice, made. It is made every time by every poet in every poem, every line, every choice.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me that if I could make a line that was a bit longer and more flexible and without stops in it, then I would be able to let syntax do more of its job and get those two rhythmic systems sort of playing together. So then I have an ensemble instead of a single instrument, if that analogy makes sense to you.
It does.
So I had been writing some poems in which I just eschewed for the moment anyway punctuation. Because as soon as you put a period, you put a comma in that line, that is a pause. That is an interruption of the rhythm. And when I did that, I also discovered that I could do a much higher degree of repetition in the syntax itself. I would allow that for the poem to pursue without going back with my scalpel and my chisel to get rid of it.
You know, I'm really enjoying this conversation so much for so many reasons. One of them is which you've done something now twice that people hardly ever do when they talk to me. Is that you've turned a question back on me and asked me and it got me to answer it. So because you were saying earlier how maybe you described yourself as willful and didactic, but I'd throw in maybe Socratic as well.
Well,
Is that the teacher in you?
Well, yeah, I think that is the teacher in me. I love teaching. It's also, I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, if you do 50 to 100 drafts of a poem, then you're trying to put everything there that the poem might need and that the reader might need. And then it belongs to the page and belongs to the reader. So for me to explain what my intention was, it always feels a little bit like cheating.
Yeah.
It always feels like, well, you know, either I put that in there or I didn't put that in there. It's not that I want the poem to be a Rorschach test and then, you know, whatever the reader wants to make of it. I'm quite willful, and I try to use all of these tools to control that reader.
I mean, I wanted to ask you about you know, did I get a taste of the teacher? Because you started the first low residency MFA program in the country in Vermont. I mean, now it's in North Carolina, but can you tell us a little bit about that? Why did you want to do that?
Well, that came out of a very just pragmatic situation. I had been teaching at Goddard for a couple of years, and they did have a low residency program, a Bachelor of Arts program. And mainly the students who came to do that program were women, non-traditional age, who had children, had jobs, had no access or no ability to really to go the usual route. And it seemed that that model was perfectly suited to writing. Because one has to, you know, go closet oneself. One has to have solitude to write the poems. So it seemed to me that it might be worthwhile to think about on the low residency model or other models, just other models that would be more more connected to mentorship and this notion of solitude and working at one's own pace.
Right. Well, what do you hope to do in the next 5 years now that you have both this accolade from the MacArthur Foundation and the money that goes along with it?
And the time.
And the time.
It's the time that the money is buying. That is just huge. First of all, I want to, you know, sort of get rid of some of the clutter in my life, in my house, in my life. Solitude. Time to think. Time to read.
Ellen, thank you. There was a bunch of other questions I could ask, but we're out of time.
We're out of time. Yes, we are.
But it really has been a great pleasure. And wait, before we go, do you have any of your other poems with you?
Yeah, I have the book.
So, Ellen, could you do me one last favor? Because I loved listening to you read Headwaters. Could you do that for us again? Is there any other poem that you could read for us?
Well, the Headwaters is first in the book, so why don't I read the last one in the book?
Okay.
Storm. 1 minute, a slender pine indistinguishable from the others. The next, its trunk horizontal, still green, the jagged stump, a nest for the flickers. 1 minute, high wind and rain, the skies lit up. The next, a few bright winking stars, the lashing of the brook. 1 minute, an exaltation in the apple trees, the shadblow trees. The next, white trash on the ground, new birds, or the same birds crowding the feeder. 1 minute, the children were sleeping in their beds. You got sick, you got well, you got sick. The lilac bush we planted is a tree. The cat creeps past with something in her mouth. She's hurrying down to where the culvert overflowed. 1 minute, bright yellow marsh marigolds springing up. The next, the farmer sweeps them into his bales of hay.
Ellen Bryant Voigt, this is the point of the conversation where I usually read a little description of who the guest is that I've been speaking to. I'm gonna freeform this one. I'm gonna say, Ellen Bryant Voigt is self-described as willful, didactic, but I'm going to add, as we said earlier, Socratic, generous, thoughtful, and now also genius. She's the winner of the 2015 MacArthur Genius Award, and she writes, teaches, and lives in Vermont. It has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, nice way to end the show. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.